All right, cool. Awesome being with you guys. If you have your Bibles, flip them open to Hebrews chapter 12. And I think it's kind of funny we're going to be in Hebrews right now because that's what we're going over Wednesday night. So you guys have been through the Wednesday night studies. We're in Hebrews 9, correct? Yeah. Yeah, we'll probably be there for another couple weeks. Maybe move on to Hebrews 10. So you guys get a little sneak peek into Hebrews 12. You're about 6 months ahead of the other church, you know? Maybe more. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how things go. But yeah, the cool thing about us being in Hebrews 9 in Wednesday night study, and I encourage you guys to listen to those studies, is because whenever we have a systematic theological book like the book of Hebrews, which is what this book is, meaning it's a book that overviews the gospel message and Christian life in reaction to the gospel message. And we have a couple books like this in our Bibles, books like Romans, Galatians, Ephesians, Colossians, Hebrews. These are books that have a very wide and broad overview of the Christian life in general. There's always a very particular format to these books. They will always begin with a focus in on grace alone being the basis for our salvation and the foundation for our relationship with God. They always have that basis. So in Romans, he takes about 5 chapters to lay this foundation. In Ephesians, he takes 3 chapters to lay the foundation. In Colossians, he takes the first 2 chapters. And in Hebrews, he takes a whopping 11 chapters to lay this foundation. The reason why I pull that out is because sometimes we could jump into the more meaty sections of scriptures, the more practical sections, the exhortation parts, which would be the latter parts of Hebrews as well as these other books, and we forget that all this foundational gospel principle message has already been laid for us, and we could jump right into the exhortation, forgetting the comfort, and we can leave feeling condemned and like we may not even have a relationship with God as a result. So I go into this section very gently, and I hope you guys will remember what has led up to this moment. That Hebrews 11 is the backdrop for Hebrews 12, and Hebrews 11 is all about how people had a right relationship with God based solely on their faith. Hebrews 11, verse 6, "For without faith it is impossible to please God, for he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him." Remember that. God rewards those who diligently seek him, not those who do the right thing every single time. Thank God, right? But God definitely rewards those who have a hunger and thirst for him and want him to believe that he is and to believe that he is a rewarder. That is what it takes to be in a right relationship with him. So now with that foundation set, let's move into Hebrews 12. So Hebrews 12 has a beginning that I'm not going to go over because I think you guys went over it last time, verses 1 through 2, which is the basis of mine and Bo's ministry, Running Light, which deals with sexual issues. But it says, "Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." So the basis of this chapter is, now that we have a right relationship with Jesus, what is the Christian life like? And he uses a metaphor. He says the metaphor is like running a marathon. So yeah, you are in relationship with God, but you have the opportunity to daily draw nearer to God. You can run the race. You can go after him. You could pursue him in very, very practical ways. And that's kind of the outline of this chapter. That's what he's going to be talking about. So in verse 3, he's going to start getting into specifics. How does this happen? "For consider him," Jesus, "who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin, and you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chastened us, as seemed best to them. But he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now no chastening seems joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. So I think that's as far as I'm going to get today. I was going to go to verse 17, but I just don't think it's going to happen. We'll see. We'll play it by ear, though. Essentially, what he's laying out for us then is this idea of what does the pursuit of Jesus feel like? What does it feel like? And unfortunately, there's good and bad news. The good news is that our run towards Christ is going to mirror Christ's move towards us. And as we saw in the first two verses of this chapter, Christ's move towards us was motivated entirely by joy. Entirely by joy. It says, for the joy set out before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame. Meaning that there was no obligatory function in what Jesus was doing. There was no idea of, I have to do this or I must do this. If I don't do this, my Father's going to be displeased with me. There was no guilt motivating him. There was no shame motivating him. There was primarily and predominantly overwhelming joy of drawing us near to him, regardless of what it cost him, which was everything. Now he says, our run towards Christ is going to mirror that. So the good news is, our run towards Christ is mirrored by joy. We as Christians, we do not pursue God out of a guilty conscience, meaning we're not running after him because we feel terrible about ourselves and we want to be better people. We are not motivated by a shame-based identity, meaning that we feel as though God doesn't like us or has no relation to us because of our wickedness and our sin. No, on the contrary, we run after God knowing that he has fully accepted us and loves us more than we can ever fully understand. I remember Paul's prayer in Ephesians chapter 3 for the church of Ephesus. And he says that we all with the saints may be able to comprehend what is the width and length and depth and height of the love of God, which surpasses understanding, that we may be filled with the totality and the fullness of God in us. So the main thing is that we are motivated by joy to pursue God, not guilt, not shame, or any type of empty, hollow, obligatory religious functionality. We are motivated because we know we are accepted and we know that we are loved. And he lays this out in a very interesting way, because when he's speaking to these people, you have to understand the context of this book, when he's speaking to these people, the people in Hebrews had gone back to the law. They were saved. They were saved by grace, but they were like, you know what? Let's go back to the function of the law. And you have to remember, the law was motivated by guilt and fear. That's how the law worked. If you didn't do good, God would curse you. But if you did well, God would bless you. That was the driving force of the law. These people had gone back to the law, and he seems to insinuate in verse 5, and you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as sons. In other words, because they had gone back to legalism, their status before God was in question. So if you ever want to know, if you want to take a little check on yourself about where you're at with God in regards to the gospel, have I slipped into legalism? Which is easy to do, by the way. Very easy. A good check that we can do on ourselves on a day-to-day basis is, what is motivating me towards God? What's motivating me away from sin? What's motivating me to read my Bible, to come to church, to fellowship with other believers, to share my faith? What is the primary motivator? If it's guilt, if it's fear, you've slipped back into legalism. If it's joy, you are washed in grace. These people had forgotten that. And so because of that, the discipline of God, which we'll talk about in a second, the discipline of God and the training of God made them feel like they weren't sons. It made them feel like they were trying to get into a relationship with God as opposed to worshiping and serving God because they already had one. The analogy that's used throughout the Bible is it's the distinction between a relationship that a son has to his father versus a relationship that an employee has towards the employer. So an employee is only good to the employer in what they are able to produce for the company. They want to be an asset to the company. And because of that, their value is completely dependent on how they're behaving. On a day that they're behaving very well and their work is very up to standard and they feel like they have something to offer, they feel very accepted and they have security within the company. They know, I cannot be fired, I cannot be let go because of look at what I'm producing. I'm doing so well. Therefore, I am owed a paycheck and I'm owed a position here. That's the mentality of an employee. A son, however, is confident of the love that the father has for them, not based on anything that they're doing, but simply based on the status that they have with the parent. And that status is something that they're born with. It's not something that they ever earned. You know, it's interesting, you know, now that we have, me and my wife have a one-year-old daughter, which is incredible and awesome. But, you know, it's cool to see how this kind of unconditional love works in the life of your child. Because when you're hanging out with your child and you really stop and think about it, you're like, wow, this kid is really draining a lot for me. You know, they're not really producing anything for me. Like, everything that would make my life easier, she does the opposite, right? I was up for like 3 or 4 hours last night because she was crying. And it's like, you know, my ability to take care of her, I'm not like, okay, I guess I'll take care of you because you take care of me on my off days. Or you think about me, or you're always looking out for my benefit and my betterment. And you love me so unconditionally. No, no, no. Her love is very conditional towards me. I don't do one thing that she wants and she loses it, right? And she's at that awesome age where she's starting to have temper tantrums. And I'm like, yeah. The fall of man, you know, in all of its glory. You just take, like, she's holding something and you take it away. She freaks out. She yells at you. Her face gets all red. And you're like, yeah, I've done you a great wrong, haven't I? You know, what a bad parent I am that I take away this one thing. But that's the idea there, that she is so convinced. Understand this. She is so assured of my unconditional love for her that she's even willing to be very, very temperamental and ugly towards me. And she has no fear. Does that make sense? My daughter has zero fear that I'm going to abandon her or leave her or let her go. She has none whatsoever. She is so confident. That confidence has nothing to do with her performance. If it did, she would have woken up this morning all dejected and like, oh, I'm so sorry. I got to catch you up last night. Do you still love me? No, but she wakes up. She looks at me in the crib. Big old smile on her face like nothing happened, right? Because she's so confident. She's so confident that I'm her dad. That's the distinction. Now, when you get into this relationship with God, notice even the discipline which is insinuates that you're messing up, right? That God is having to do something to you because you are failing. You're not doing the right thing. He says even the discipline is evidence of God's love for you. Now, we don't usually feel that way. We're being disciplined. We mess up before God. Once again, we begin to question our status before God. We begin to fear God. Now, before I move any further, there's a kind of an interesting opposition to what I've been saying. Some of you might even be thinking of it, those who are more biblically literate than others. You would say, well, doesn't it say in the Bible that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom? So what do you mean that we shouldn't be relating to God on a fear-based relationship, but that we should have this confidence and assurance and boldness before God to say anything, which is, by the way, what the book of Hebrews says, Hebrews 4, verse 16. Therefore, since we do not have a heavenly priest or a high priest that cannot relate to us in our infirmities and struggles, but was tempted in all ways as we are, yet without sin, we come boldly before the throne of grace that we might receive help in our time of need. That word boldly literally means to say anything, to be so confident of a relationship with someone that you feel like you could say anything to them and your relationship would not be hurt in any way. But you would say, well, if all that's true, how do we square the idea that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom? How do we understand this principle? Well, it's a difficult one, and one that I don't have a whole lot of time to go into. If you have your Bibles, flip them back all the way to Psalm 132. And this will maybe, it's not an end of the discussion, but hopefully it will give you an interesting idea of what, I'm sorry, 130, not 132. An interesting idea of how this conflict, this seeming conflict might work its way out in the Christian life. Psalm 130, verse 3. If you, Lord, should mark iniquities, if you should mark our failures, who could stand? But there is forgiveness with you, notice this next part, that you may be feared. Does that sound odd to any of you guys in English? On what basis is the psalmist saying we should fear God? On the basis of his wrath? On the basis of his justice? No, on the basis of his mercy. Does that sound weird? Sounds totally like an oxymoron, doesn't it? Have you ever heard anyone talk like that in your day-to-day life? I am so afraid of that guy. Why are you so afraid of him? He is so merciful. I'm terrified of him. I'm shaking in my boots because he's so merciful. That sounds weird, but that's what the writer of the Psalms is saying. He's saying we fear God because he forgives iniquity, not because he holds us accountable, which he does. But on the basis of his forgiveness, that is why we should fear God. That alone should show us that maybe our understanding of fear in English might be a little bit different than the understanding in the Greek and the Hebrew. That perhaps they had a very, not different, but more nuanced view of fear. And we see throughout the Bible that fear does not denote necessarily terror or phobia, but it can actually denote the idea of reverence and sovereignty. That I look at God with awe and respect. What is one of the reasons why I respect God? Because of his mercy. Because of his loving kindness. That's why I respect God. One of the reasons anyway. So the ideas that I'm saying are not in conflict with the ideas of fearing God being the basis of wisdom. So I wanted to remove that obstacle from the rest of this sermon before we move forward. Notice also in verse 3, for consider him, we're considering Jesus, who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. The basis of this study also, we could say, at the very end, you notice it says that we are trained by this type of discipline as well as this type of pursuit. The word trained in Greek, it's the word gymnasio. Guess what word we get from that? Gymnasium. Right? So the idea of this chapter is that we're training, right? The metaphor is a marathon. You got to train to run a marathon, unless you're just naturally awesome. But most of us would have to train to do that. And he's saying that this is what's going on. We're training to be able to run towards God and to be able to honor him with our lives. Now, the main obstacle towards being trained, those of you guys who have ever done any type of training, is discouragement. It's believing that you can't do something or that what you're doing is not worth it when it is within your capacity to do so. There's this one psychologist, he tells a story, and I think it's so funny. He said he was in a waiting room, and he was watching the kids. You know, you're in a waiting room, not anymore because of COVID, but it used to be back in the day, those of you guys who remember back past a year. There used to be a day where you would sit in a waiting room. There would be magazines and toys and things like that. And little kids would be playing with all these toys, and you'd be waiting for your time to be called to the doctor or whatever you're waiting for. And he said he was watching these little kids, and they were playing with this toy. And it was like a jack-in-the-box type thing. And in order to make this jack-in-the-box come out, instead of just winding it, you had to also press a button, right? So you push the button, you wound it, and then it would pop out. He said he watched this boy trying to figure this thing out. And he wound it, nothing happened. He pushed the button, nothing happened. Then he did what all boys did. He threw it, nothing happened. And he started to cry. He couldn't figure it out, so he just started to cry and he gave up. His friend watched him do this And instead of even trying or attempting to work this toy, he just started crying right off the bat. Just seeing this kid fail was enough to discourage him from even trying. Then this little girl comes over. She picks up the toy. She does the same thing. She winds it. Nothing happens. She pushes a button. Nothing happens. She inspects it, looks at it up and down. And she pushes the button and she winds it and it comes out and she gets so elated and excited. And he said, now what's the difference between the girl and the boy? The boys, should I say. Is it that the boys were incapable of doing that? Were they intellectually and physically inferior to this girl so that they could not figure out this toy or they couldn't work it? No. The only difference between them was not capability. It was perceived capability. They believed they couldn't do it, and so they didn't even try. What we believe we are capable of doing has great impact on what we actually are able to accomplish. Discouragement will always prevent you from doing the extraordinary. You have no idea what you are capable of until somebody pushes you. And that person who pushes you must also believe in you. You know, the Marines, I couldn't believe the things I was able to do in the Marine Corps, things I never thought I was going to be able to do, right? Not just physically, but mentally, right? Being able to seriously sleep in a hole that I dug for 2 months out of my life with no shower, no running water, no food, no contact with friends and family, no electronics, all these things being shot out on a daily basis, all these things happening, and I was fine. I thrived. Never thought I would be able to do it, but I did it. Never thought I would be able to walk 26 miles with 100 pounds of gear on my back, but I did it. Now, what we also learned in the Marines is that it's not really the people who succeeded in the Marine Corps were not necessarily the most physically fit. Some very physically fit people actually dropped out. They didn't make it. It was the people with the strongest will. The people who had confidence, belief. Those who did not become discouraged easily. Another component to this idea of not becoming discouraged, it's not just the confidence we have in God, it's not just the idea that God is motivating and pushing us, but it has everything to do with your expectations. A lot of the physically fit people, so remember I said a lot of physically fit people did not make it. One of the reasons why is because they were so confident in their strength that they didn't think it was going to be a challenge. And so when it challenged them, and they felt like, oh my gosh, I can't do this. They panicked, they became afraid, and they gave up. In other words, they had an expectation of ease when they should have had an expectation of difficulty. In fact, they should have had an expectation that what they were going to be doing was going to be beyond their capabilities. That should have been their expectation, but they didn't have it. Why do I say this is relevant? Notice, right after he talks about discouragement, what does he say? You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. Now, some people believe that this is referencing Jesus being crucified, because in this context, the people in Hebrews, this book, they're beginning to be persecuted. And some people have taken that to mean you have not yet been killed for your faith. So therefore, continue to persevere. Now, there's several reasons of why that doesn't work. The first and most important reason is that Christians were already being martyred by this time. Think about Stephen in Acts chapter 7. This guy's saying, you haven't yet resisted to the shedding of blood. Beyond that, in Hebrews 10, he also talks about physical violence being done towards the Christians. So that can't possibly be the interpretation. The second reason why it fails is because of the end of the sentence. You have not yet resisted bloodshed, striving against sin. Not sinners. Sin. What the heck is he talking about? Can you guys think of a time in the Bible where somebody resisted sin, and by resisting sin, they shed blood? You guys think of a time that happened? How about the Garden of Gethsemane? Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, before the crucifixion, before the cross, he was wrestling so much with a sinful inclination. What was the inclination? I don't want to die. I don't want to die. Father, if it be your will, let this cup pass from me. I don't want to die, Father. I don't want to go through this. Let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. He says he prayed that over and over and over again, and he was so pressed by this temptation that he began to sweat great drops of blood. What kind of expectations do Christians have when it comes to battling sin? I would say that if you listen to a lot of sermons from a lot of pastors, the expectation is ease and comfort. That it's simple. That fighting sin is easy. That beating it is even easier. All you have to do is repent and do better. You just have to stop and merely quit the negative behaviors that are taking over your life. In fact, the majority of pastors have a very interesting idea that the reason why people sin is mainly out of ignorance. That perhaps they just don't know better. And my job as a pastor is to educate people about the wrongful doings that they have in their life so that they will simply stop doing them. The writer of Hebrews here seems to vastly disagree with that understanding. Did Jesus know better? Did Jesus know better that that was what he was supposed to do? Of course he did. Just two chapters earlier, he says in John 14, "What shall I say? Father, deliver me from this present moment. It was for this moment I came to this world." Jesus knew what he was supposed to do. His conflict wasn't about knowledge. His conflict was about temptation and suffering and present agony. When you and I fight sin, the issue isn't our knowledge. It's not that we don't know better. It's worse. It's that we know better, but we don't know how to stop. That's our issue. It was easier for me when I was in ignorance, when I didn't know that these behaviors were wrong. There was no conflict. There was no struggle. I liked viewing pornography. I liked going after sexual things. I liked my anger. I liked my wrath. I liked my arrogance. Everything about my sinful nature, I loved. There was no fight. The only fight was maybe to become a little bit worse. But there was no fight to become better. The fight didn't even start until I gave my life to Jesus Christ. And unfortunately, from sermons and from testimonies, we can get this idea of like, yeah, you know, I was the worst sinner ever, but then I came to God and all this stuff just melted away. Hey, that may have happened. I don't doubt it. Maybe it happened. It happens sometimes. In particular areas, right? When I came to God, there were some things that just melted away. You're right. But there was a lot of things that didn't. A lot of things didn't. And that is what I need to fight. That is what I need to contend against. That is what I need to train myself to struggle against. That's what we all need to do. We have not yet resisted to bloodshed. I've been tempted before. Man, I've struggled before. I've been up at night resisting temptation before. I've never shed blood. I've never sweat blood resisting like that. If I did, I'd probably call a doctor. That would scare the crap out of me, right? Never has that happened to me. What is the writer of Hebrews saying? He's saying, man, if it hasn't happened to you, you're getting off light. You think your temptation is hard? You're getting off light, man. What did Jesus say? No servant is greater than his master. No servant is greater than his master. What makes you think that your temptation will be easier to resist than Christ's? Are you more holy than Christ? Are you more righteous than Christ? Do you know more of God than Christ? What in you makes you think that your struggle against temptation will be easier than Christ? What a foolish idea that we have had as a church and a body. Temptation is not an easy thing to fight. And some might say, well, it seems pretty easy to me. Here's what I'll say to you. The reason why it seems easy to you is not that temptation is weak, it's that your will is weak. In other words, and I mean this not to be incredibly condemning, but I mean this to be very much convicting and challenge you. Someone who goes to the gym and only lifts the bar at the bench press may not feel challenged. but it's because they're not challenging themselves. If you feel like resisting sin is easy, may I ask, how vehemently do you fight your sin? Are you even aware of your sin? Do you even know the sins that you struggle with? Just ask the people around you. Believe me, they're far more versed in your evil behavior than you are. You're immune to it. You know, in my time as a pastor, I sometimes do hospital visits and home visits of people who are elderly. And I hate doing the home visits because when people get elderly, especially if they have animals, especially cats, they just let those little demons, I hate cats, by the way, they just let those little demonic creatures run around, pee and poop on everything. And the pee of cats is like the most god-awful scent on this planet. I don't know why God created cats other than for us to just hate and for them to like kill rodents in the street. But I absolutely hate cats. And you go into this house and you're just like, oh my gosh, like you're gagging smelling this up. And this person's just chilling, eating a bag of Doritos, watching TV, maybe smoking a cigarette. And they're like, what's up? You know, they're totally good. They don't even notice. Why? It's because they are so used to it. They're so accustomed to it that they don't even notice it. Could it be that if you think the struggle against sin is easy, could it be that maybe you're accustomed to it? It's not that it's not evil. It's not that other people don't notice. It's just that you're accustomed to it. You're used to it. You like you so much that you're not going to call out your own foibles. But God will. Those of us who really want to fight our sin, we're going to feel a contest in us. We're going to feel a struggle. It's one of the reasons why we meet together. I don't know how many of you guys have tried to motivate yourselves when you get to the gym. You could do it. You know, some of us have enough willpower to do it. But you will always find more encouragement and strength and unity if you have someone there with you. Someone there with you. And, you know, having a coach is good. Having someone who just yells at you is cool, I guess. But you know what's even better? Having someone who's struggling with you, isn't it? Having someone who is lifting the same weights as you are, you see them going through the same struggles, that you're able to motivate one another. It says in Ecclesiastes 4, it says, two are better than one, for they have a good return for their investment. For how will you get up if you fall and you are all by yourself? Or how will you keep warm if you lay down in the cold and you have no one by you to keep you warm? There's an idea there that we join together as a church, not merely to be educated, but to be together in this fight, to encourage one another, to strengthen one another, to be there for each other, to share in the honesty of what the Christian life is all about. God has no need for hypocrites. God has no need for platitudes of righteousness. He's not pleased by it. He's not happy about it. God does not smile at the church when we come and we act as if our lives are together. God isn't in heaven like, oh, wow, they seem so great. I'm so pleased. God is pleased with actual righteousness. God is pleased with honesty and integrity. God is pleased when people come together and they find the strength and the courage to be real and genuine with their brothers and to be trained by the discipline of the Lord together. That's when God is really pleased with this church. I think some people believe that the church was created simply to be a place where we can condemn wicked things. It's true and it's not true. You have to understand, though, the wicked things that the church is here to condemn reside predominantly in you. The church is not here to complain about the culture. The culture doesn't know God. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5, what do I have to do with condemning the culture? He's like, they're not of the house of God. Why would I be shocked if people who don't know God act like it, right? Why would that be surprising to me? The church is not here to condemn the culture. The church is not here to condemn politics. The church is not here to even evaluate our good deeds. The church is here to condemn predominantly the evil and wickedness that resides in the congregants so that we might grow together and fight our sin together in a unified manner. That's why we need each other, and that's why we need the church. Now, interestingly, he gives us a way to look at discipline. So what happens if we do blow it? and discipline starts happening. He makes a really interesting argument that we should actually be really, really happy when we're disciplined. I don't know how many of us are, though. But he actually makes an argument that we ought to be happy. Notice his argument. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed, for a few days, chastened us as seemed best to them. But he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now, really cool right here. He's saying that we ought to respond with joy when we are disciplined by God. Why? Because that is evidence that you belong to him, that you're saved. And here's again the distinction. When an employer sits you down and disciplines you, you have to understand something. Number one, unless you have a really good boss, that boss doesn't care about you. He cares about what you're doing to the company. Does that make sense? He cares about what you're doing, how you're failing him, and you're ruining the company. That's what that boss cares about. His discipline, therefore, is not designed to make you a better person. It is designed to make you a better employee. In other words, it is designed only to make you more valuable to him. There is no love, there is no compassion there. There is simply a desire for selfish preservation. That's when a boss disciplines you. Beyond that, when you sit down and are disciplined by a boss, you know this could be my last time. He has the power to fire me. And there's a fear there. Discipline between a father and son is completely different. Discipline between a father and son, true discipline, real discipline, not abuse, is done because you care about your child. You care so much about them, actually, that you are willing to undergo pain as a parent in disciplining your child when you don't want to. That's how loving this action is. I don't want to hurt my son, but I fear so much this behavior will hurt him infinitely more than my hand ever will, or my grounding ever will, or whatever discipline that you have in mind for them. I believe that this sin, this evil behavior that he has, will be so much more destructive to him in the future that I am willing to subject him to punishment and even incur his anger towards me as a result. That's how much I love him. Any apathetic parent could go without disciplining their child. It takes a truly loving parent to motivate themselves to discipline when they do not want to. And again, discipline. Abuse is discipline that is doled out like an employer. I don't really care how this impacts you or affects you. You're just making me angry and I want you to stop it. You're upsetting me. You're disappointing me. You're letting me down. That's not discipline. Notice the goal of discipline that he talks about. The goal of discipline is to be corrected that we might live in holiness for our profit, verse 10. For our profit. That's why he disciplines us. That's true and genuine discipline. I love you so much that for your profit, I am disciplining you. Not because I hate you, not because I'm angry at you. In fact, true discipline is never done out of anger. The reason why Jesus died on our behalf is so that God could dispense of anger, so that when he disciplines us, it is completely devoid of anger. God never disciplines his children out of anger because Christ took the totality of God's anger. He has no more left to give. Jesus absorbed it all that we might receive only love and grace from our Father. So that means that when he disciplines us, there is no anger present, only compassion and only desire for our betterment. It's not exactly a lesson. This is not supposed to be a lesson for fathers, but it is an interesting idea, isn't it? That should be the perspective on discipline. Should be in an ideal world. But that is how God always views it. And perhaps if we don't view discipline correctly as Christians, maybe we had bad examples of it when we were children. Think back to the way that you were disciplined as a child. Some of us have good examples, but some of us have very bad ones. Maybe we were disciplined out of anger. and our parents never apologized for it. Maybe we were disciplined out of selfish desire and attempts by our parents just to conform us to what they wanted, as opposed to what was best for us. Maybe that is our experience, and therefore it is difficult for you to see discipline from your Heavenly Father as a good thing. But God has come that he might unright your understanding of these things, and that he might build up a better one, that he might cleanse you of what was previously tarnished by the sinfulness of your parents, and he might show you something better. Discipline's not the problem. The problem is the attitude of the person doing the discipline and the attitude of the person receiving it. Do not be discouraged when your father disciplines you. It's a good thing. You know, sometimes in the group, I'll have guys come in, been cheating on their wives, been viewing pornography for a while, they lost their job, they're losing their marriage, their kids can't stand them, all this stuff. And they're like, God must hate me. And I'll always show them this passage. And I'll say, no, man, God loves you. He loves you so much that he was willing to allow these consequences to happen in your life that your soul may be saved. Because God knows that the worst thing that could happen to you is not that you lose your marriage, is not that you lose your job, is not that you lose your health or the respect of your children. The worst thing that can happen is that your relationship with him will be impacted and affected and even maybe torn asunder by your apathy towards him and your desire to go your own way. God would rather shake you out of that apathy with discipline than allow you to continue to walk away from him. That's how much he loves you. To see this as a loving act, though, is a difficult thing. And he even admits it. No chastening seems joyful for the present, right? It doesn't seem good. When you work out, it never feels good afterwards. Right, you got some endorphins going, that's great, but then you wake up the next morning, you can't move, and you're like, what did I do to myself? Right, it doesn't seem good. Nevertheless, what? Afterward, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Why do people keep going back to the gym? It's because afterward, it's doing something for them. It is profiting them. The pain, in the moment, it doesn't feel that way. And this is why it's so difficult. This is why discipline is so difficult. It's one of the most incredibly hard things for a parent to ever help their kid understand. Because kids, when you have a child, they're completely consumed with the present moment. Completely. They cannot think 2 seconds ahead. Right? When you see a 2-year-old wolfing down Halloween candy November 1st, and you're like, you're going to get a stomach ache, things like that, they don't care. They're not like, oh, I did this last year. Perhaps I should learn from my mistakes. No, they don't think that way. I've never heard a 4-year-old say, you know, I'm really worried about cavities, so I don't think I should eat these. You know, I've had enough. You know, Dad, thanks for offering me ice cream before dinner, but I'm really worried about my body. You know, calorie intake, you know, heart disease. No, thank you. You know, I'm going to stick to healthy stuff. No kid thinks that way. They only think about the present moment. They're wrapped into it. They only understand it. And because of that, they're in bondage to their desires. They don't know how to say no. Now, the illusion is that you ever really grow out of that. Growing out of that mentality is not something that happens naturally. It only happens through discipline. Only happens through discipline. What discipline does is it introduces an immediate consequence to something that would take years for you to feel its effects. That's what discipline does. So your child does something wrong. Let's say they're lying. How long will it take for lying to catch up to and to start harming a child if they start doing it on a regular basis? Years. It'll take years because all kids are liars, right? They're all lying, right? I hang out with my nephews and nieces. They lie without even knowing it. They don't even think about it. They're telling stories and they're like, yeah, this happened and that happened. And then my teacher said to go do this. And I'm like, your teacher didn't say that. Like, yeah, they didn't say that. You know, like, so they back off it really quick, but they lie all the time. Like, all kids are liars. How long does it take for lying to really catch up and start hurting someone? Years, maybe even decades. And you as a parent know that. So you are introducing immediate consequences to something that would take years for it to hurt them. Does that make sense? That's what discipline does. But discipline doesn't stop there. Discipline must be instructed and communicated in a way where you're saying, this is an immediate consequence, but I am protecting you from something that you don't even understand yet. A five-year-old does not understand failed relationships as a result of deception. They don't get that. They don't know what it's like to lie to someone that trusts them and have that person lose trust for them and confidence in them. They have no clue what you're talking about. When you're disciplining, you're trying to instruct them on that reality so that they stop that behavior. That's the whole point. And so that they learn about results. They learn that, hey, some things take a while for me to see the results of them. They don't happen immediately. They take time. In other words, you're trying to elevate the mentality of your child to understand long-reaching effects when all they can understand as kids is short-term benefit or consequence. That's what God's trying to do with you as well. Don't you realize that when God is looking at your life, he sees an eternal life? We become so frustrated because God allows temporary inflictions of harm to happen in us. We're like, why would God do that? Don't you realize that he sees things from an eternal standpoint? And maybe even a decade of consequences may seem like the majority of your life. To God, it's nothing. It's like you're just not old enough to realize what I'm trying to do with you. You haven't yet matured enough to realize that what I'm doing is for your betterment, even though you won't even be able to experience the benefit, maybe for years, but it's coming. Discipline requires faith and trust in the one performing the discipline. That is how we are able to not see, but to believe in the moment when you're like, this is painful, I don't like this. In the moment to believe that God is doing something beautiful, though you cannot see it. With the eyes of faith, you are believing. So, that's all I got for you guys for today. Let me pray. I believe we have another song that we're going to do, right?
Sure.
Maybe? Yeah. Yeah. I think we're going to do another song and then we'll wrap up for today. Father, we thank you so much for your word. We do pray that it would speak to us continually, that we would be able to wrestle with these words and understand the truth of the Christian life, that is not something that we should look at with an expectation of ease, but difficulty should be something that we anticipate and are ready for. Lord, help us to pursue you and to love you, to see your discipline as a joyous and beautiful thing, to always come close to you as you try to guide us. Lord, help us not to be like the horse and the mule that needs a bit and bridle to move him along the way. Help us to be surrendered to you so that a simple nudge and a gentle whisper would be sufficient to move us in the direction that you want for us. God, we love you. We thank you. In your name, amen.